Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen to us. We appreciate it. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to think you're a hater. Coming up, Jerry Jones lost his mind talking about this 18-game football season again. Some points about the WNBA and their salary issues that I think you may not have considered, but first, oh yeah, we got people in the NFL getting paid. And then we got the cast that aren't getting paid. Understand that doesn't seem like a significant distinction, but in newsworthiness, here we are. Odell Beckham got his bread from the New York Giants. He is the highest paid receiver in the NFL. Aaron Rodgers just got a 4-year, $134 million extension that comes with over $100 million in guarantees. To a degree, it is a bit of a silly season with the money, except not really silly. With Beckham, it was interesting because, you know, Beckham said he wanted to be the highest paid offensive player in the league. I just think it's worth noting that I would also like to be the highest paid offensive player in the NFL. And I believe that you would like to be the highest paid offensive player in the NFL. Like, I'm not really mad at somebody because they say they want to make a bunch of money. I haven't met the person yet that really didn't want to make a bunch of money. And that includes a lot of them revolutionary types out there. I don't see what happened to them when they get some money, get some leather in them car seats. All of a sudden, now I look on capitalism, flip all the way up like, oh, wow, so supple. Yeah, man, everybody want to get paid. So, like, Beckham saying that was what he wanted, okay. I mean, he weren't going to get it, and he did wind up coming out pretty well. It seemed pretty clear that he and the Giants had made a deal. Y'all lay low. I lay low. We'll get this whole thing done. He showed up to all the camp stuff and everything else, which tells me, in spite of everything that people had to say about Odell Beckham and all that, we don't know if he's going to be able to grow up, he can control himself. And I do think that some of those points were legitimate. I want to make that clear. But I can't believe that any of you actually thought for a moment that that dude was not going to be re-upping with the Giants. People out here thinking they're going to trade him. No. Look, they made the decision that they're trying to win this year. I don't know how wise a decision it was for them to decide that they were going to do that. But I think they made a bad decision in taking Saquon Barkley. Not because I think that Saquon Barkley is a bad player or I don't think that he'll be good. He probably will be. But they had an opportunity to get a quarterback for the future. And they decided to go out there and get the ghost of Eli Pass, or hope that the ghost of Eli Pass shows up. Because the ghost of Eli present wasn't looking so good. And the ghost of Eli future, he's just retired. And they've made this call. Like, they decided to run this back one more game with Eli Manning. And if you're going to run it back one more game with Eli Manning, I'm assuming you're doing this because you believe that Eli Manning will be good enough to be a quarterback next year too. Because if you think that Eli Manning was good enough to be a quarterback this year, but probably won't be next year, then again, you take a quarterback like high, and they did not. Right. So they think they've got the Eli Manning thing straight. From what I have seen in the last 3-4 years, how good Eli Manning is really closely tied to whether Odell Beckham is playing. Now, he controls that offense in that way. He demands attention in that way. That is hard to find. One thing that's interesting that's going on in the Le'Veon Bell negotiations is Bell's agent has made the point in the past where he said they are trying to pay the position and not the player. And that's the thing that happens a lot to elite running backs, because the position does not dictate that much money, but there are still some game-changing type of players. Like, we saw Todd Gurley get the bag not that long ago because he is one of those rare types who matters in that way from the running back position. Le'Veon Bell, I mean, he's that kind of guy also. Still doesn't want to pay the position. They don't want to pay the dude. Beckham seemed to be fighting against that, and the reason seemed to be pretty clear. As a singular player, as an individual, he has had a huge effect on the offense that he plays in. And so, yeah, they gave him his money. Now, that lets us come back here on this other side. We're going to start playing air to sports writer games about, well, now he's got to show that, you know, he's responsible enough to handle that contract. Actually, you don't. Like, he got it.
Yeah, you see him with the polo and, oh, yeah, you know, I'm trying to act all professional and mature now that I've got this contract.
Yeah, come on, man. Look, if he had to be mature to get the contract, that would have been before the contract. Like, no, he doesn't have to do that. It would stand to reason that he should do some of that.
And like he buttoned it up to the top, looking like he was going out to meet his girl's parents or something.
Yeah, man, that's a guy. Hey, man, you know, I bet the Giants were like, "Look, he did something with a collar." That's what they probably said. Wear a collared shirt, and he showed up with a polo. But the thing for me with him is, I don't care about the off-season stuff. I don't care about the pictures. I don't care about any of that stuff. What is worrisome about Beckham is that in the game, like, while he is at work, we have seen him melt down. We've seen him go on full tilt multiple occasions, right? I don't care about, like, the sideshow element of it. I'm simply talking about how well he plays when he goes on tilt. And he does not play well when he does that. Like that game against Josh Norman a couple years ago, the first time we really saw him just lose it. He was killing Josh Norman. Like, he was lighting Josh Norman up, but he dropped, like, at least two touchdown passes. It might have been a third one because he simply could not keep himself together. I think that there will be some positive progress on that. And you know why I think there'll be some positive progress on that? Just because the dude is getting older. Like, I mean, some of this is like, we like to make grand narrative stuff out of that, right? About, you know, understanding the weight of the responsibility that you got and everything else. And you just get older, right? You just stop being you get farther away from childhood. And at least for most people, you then get farther away from childish behavior. And I would imagine that that's probably what's going to happen with him. Like, Beckham turns 26 this year, right? There's a big difference between 26 and 23. And so, yeah, he'll live up to it in that way, I suppose. But sports writers can't wait. They can't wait. We love something like that. Because, like, if he does wind up coming out here balling, see, the thing is, we need to find a way to say that his balling is really that we were right. So you have the whole set of people that have done all the stuff about him that is going to come around. And then what happens is, see, he's grown up the way that we were telling him to grow up. Like, the same way my favorite sports writer trick is, we blame someone for being a distraction when we are the ones that turn the distraction into cash money, right? Like, we spending gold off those distractions. We going to wag our finger at him. Man, please, your kid's in private school. Tell you talking about. Also, I mentioned the Aaron Rodgers getting his money, $100 million in guarantees. You got to send a shout out to Kirk Cousins under those circumstances, right? Like, I feel like there's no way around it. You have to. Kirk Cousins got $84 million guaranteed. And you know what he did while getting that $84 million guaranteed? Be Kirk Cousins. Like, I want to be clear to you that I don't mean this as any variety of insult to Kirk Cousins. But he is what he is. And even those who were the most invested in making him seem as good as they possibly could, those people were telling you that we weren't really dealing with, like, some supernova of a quarterback. Like, that's not him. He has put up some really, really attractive numbers. Something I think that gets lost in the Kirk Cousins, like, good numbers thing. Jay Gruden, whom I've had lots of criticisms, but Jay Gruden got big numbers out of Andy Dalton. Like, as an offensive coordinator, Jay Gruden is pretty good at this, right? Like, I mean, he doesn't run the ball enough, but your quarterback will put up numbers with him. Now, my feeling about the world is, if you can't confidently say someone is a better quarterback than Andy Dalton, then maybe you shouldn't give him $84 million. And how confident are you that Kirk Cousins is a better quarterback than Andy Dalton? Like, seriously. I'm here for the arguments in either direction. That means that neither one of them dudes need to be getting no contract with no guaranteed $84 million. But the market played out the way that it did, and Cousins played it fantastically and wound up with what you really, really want if you're a guy like him in a situation like that. A team that feels like it's a quarterback away from the Super Bowl, and you're the best quarterback that's available. So that's what they did. They went and got him. But, man, once you give Kirk Cousins $84 million, man, if you're Aaron Rodgers, you got to be, like, salivating. Like, I said on Twitter a little while ago that this has got to be, like, for this market, the Cousins contract has got to be like when John Hot Rod Williams was the highest paid player in the NBA for a little while. Like, we all got to eat now if John Hot Rod Williams is the highest paid player in the league. Cousins gets 84, you're damn right Aaron Rodgers is going to wind up getting 100-something million dollars guaranteed. Now, Mike Florio, Pro Football Talk, makes the point that it's possible over the course of the next 6 years that Cousins will make more money than Aaron Rodgers. And it is kind of possible. Like, he's not wrong there, although I think part of the reason that Cousins get that under those circumstances is a function of age. Aaron Rodgers is a lot older than Kirk Cousins. I get how that would answer the direction that it goes in. We can't just be acting like these guys playing in their 40s is promise. I mean, you're going to see it a lot, and in some cases it might even be likely because of the length the NFL has gone to try to protect quarterbacks and keep them healthy, but it ain't promise. Like, you can't put no money on the fact that this is what's going to happen. But Cousins has set the game up for everybody else. Like, everybody got to be type lovely. You just can't, like, if you're a quarterback in the top half of the NFL and it's time for you to get your money, and Kirk Cousins has gotten $84 million guaranteed over 3 years, they have to pay you, right?
It's interesting how with that it's kind of like next man up to get his contract restructured and all that sort of stuff. But it's like Todd Gurley got his money. It's not like Le'Veon Bell's is like, all right, I'm next now. My new contract.
But you know, the difference, though, is that the arc of a quarterback's career is so much different. Like, the lifespan, in effect, is so much different. Because the problem with Le'Veon Bell is he's coming up on that age where you don't pay running backs. Like, the running backs get in this horrible situation because they have to play cheap young. But after they're not young, nobody wants them. So a quarterback plays 5 years, you're just getting to where they want you to be, and they'll give you the big money to continue to get better. The teams, I don't think they're wrong in most of these cases. You get a running back that's 26, 27 years old, you don't pay them. Like, 28 is pretty much the line at which this running back thing tends to fall off, and we can go through the annals of history and look at all kinds of great running backs, and when it ended, it ended. Like, there is rarely a warning to when it's going to end for a running back. Last year, Le'Veon Bell didn't make big plays. He didn't have the runs over 20 yards like he had in previous years. His yards per carry were way down. Now, maybe that changes this year. I don't know what the small breaks were that might have been, but none of that's encouraging if you're Pittsburgh and talking about sinking in huge money for him in the form of some sort of long-term contract. Like, it just doesn't work that way. But with quarterbacks, man, people think they can play forever. And I think great quarterbacks can play for a very long time. I don't know how long you can expect these decent quarterbacks to keep this thing going. Like, how many of these decent quarterbacks are able to stay at starter level into their 40s? The great ones, by and large, are the ones who are able to do that. Now, they're not all great, right? Like, Vinny Testaverde managed to play into his 40s, and he was not a great quarterback. You'll have people argue about him being a good one. And, I mean, whatever. I'm just not about to argue with people about no Vinny Testaverde. But, you know, okay, you live your life. But no, Cousins got that bag. Everybody else got to get that bag. That's why, like, the NBA had that lockout after Kevin Garnett got that contract. The owners were like, ho, bag distribution must cease until we get some order to things.
Or even like a couple of years ago when Mike Conley got the huge contract.
But that didn't reset the game, right? Like, Conley's contract was a byproduct of the cap spike. And so there was increased money available, and then it was given. Cousins is just a middling player who had all the leverage in the world because of the incompetence of Washington. And he turned that into like a market setting deal. Like, the guys that were going to get those deals over what Conley was getting were going to get those anyway. Like, Chris Paul was going to get a max deal anyway. Cousins changed the fortunes of the entire position. And I'm telling you, I guess Aaron Rodgers got this done in a way that they could manage. But I had said, don't be surprised if Kirk Cousins wound up being the cause of a lockout. Because Aaron Rodgers ain't the only person that's going to get some bread on the basis of this. I tell you, though, if I'm one of those other quarterbacks, I'm mad, though. You should have tried to get your contract in before Aaron Rodgers did. Because Aaron Rodgers is the ceiling. Like, you're coming in under this $100 million in guarantees. If you could have got something out there before Aaron Rodgers, you really had a chance to eat. Now, I mean, you still gonna eat. Be sure to send a thank you card to Kirk Cousins. All right, Jerry Jones. Oh, Jerry. Gabe, do you remember that time that Jerry Jones said that he wanted to get back to winning a championship because it had been so long since they won a championship? He wanted one, and he referred to winning a championship or the idea of winning a championship, an expression of his desire to win a championship, as, quote, I want me some glory hole. He said that, like, in front of people, like, without a hint of irony. I never knew what he really did say that.
What is the what's the explanation there? This is just old, so he doesn't know.
I don't know. Like, I don't know what that means. Something different in Arkansas, but nah, because like, like they got Stuckies in Arkansas. You know, they got roadside stops in Arkansas. But that's what Jerry said. So like, Jerry really wants to win another championship. Did you see this? Where Jerry said that they asked him if he would give up like his place in the Hall of Fame for a championship, and he was like, no. But he said he would write a check that was obscene in order to get that. And I totally believe it, because Jerry Jones is 75 and has lots of money. Like, at this point, I imagine Jerry Jones should be writing obscene checks for everything. You don't love your kids that much. Take, you know, spend your money as you see so fit. But that being said, Jerry still wants to make a lot of money. And one thing that Jerry has long wanted to do in trying to make more money is play an 18-game season. He thinks that you should cut the preseason by 2 games, and I think there's an argument to be made there. But he wants to have an 18-game NFL season. Gabe, did you realize that before they went to the 16-game NFL season, that they used to play 6 preseason games?
Wow. That's a little bit before my time, I think.
It's before my time, too, to be clear. they used to play 6 preseason games. So this idea of cutting down preseason to add to regular season is not without precedent. Jerry also argued, and I'm asking you to help me out with this one. Jerry argued that decreasing the number of preseason games would also perhaps bring a decline in the number of concussions.
I mean, I think in the stupidity, there's like something that he could have accidentally stumbled on, which is when you're in the preseason, there's a lot of players that aren't as good. And because they aren't as good, they don't hit maybe properly. So because they're not hitting properly, there's a higher increase of injury, or like guys who are more out of shape and are trying to like get back in the game.
And high levels of desperation.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Like, oh, you know, like with Boobie Miles and yes, the Friday Night Lights, it's like he's trying to save his whole season in one carry.
Yes.
You know, these guys are back for the kick return. I'm like, all right, I gotta make this team.
Right.
I gotta get to the end zone. This is my shot.
Rent's due on the first, right? Like, they like that. That is perhaps the best argument that you could make on that one. The counter argument that I made about it is that, I mean, it's a cynical argument from the NFL standpoint, but you'll feel me. The guys who are playing 75% of the preseason games aren't going to be on NFL rosters for very long anyway.
And you feel bad for those guys, right? Because now instead of 4 games, They got 2 games to really sell it and actually be on the team before they get cut.
Yeah, it's a lot harder to make dreams come true under those circumstances. But it's just the farce of the NFL where they want to try to sell people on this idea of player safety, and then they talk about adding 2 more games. Think about this, man. Ray Lewis, right? Like our ultimate modern warrior. Ray Lewis looked at 18 games and was like, nope, sorry, not tough enough for that. Ray Lewis is like, that's too much to ask of us. No, like, this is a horrible idea. It's going to wind up creating worse football. That's the other part. The football isn't going to be very good if you keep stretching it out in that way. But they just want to make the money, man. Like, all they care about on this way is to make the money. Now, I know that's not the most novel observation to say that a capitalist enterprise is primarily concerned with just making money. But the thing that gets me about the NFL with this is, what you got, or what you had at least, was going over really, really well. Now, even if you're making the money right now, we spend more time talking about what's wrong with the NFL than we spend talking about actual NFL games, right? Or talking about actual NFL players. And you're never going to convince me that that does not eventually catch up with your bottom line as you go on. It does, right? Like, people don't feel as good about the NFL as they used to. And one thing that I think is worth noting, when you look at like a lot of the really big, like stalwart American companies, right? People feel good about them. Like, you watch a McDonald's commercial, for example, McDonald's commercials are all about how good McDonald's makes you feel, right? Like associating with your family and all that stuff. You know, that's where they're giving you in that. Coca-Cola does the same thing, Gabe. You know, you're doing the polar bears and stuff like that. Like, they're trying to make you feel good. They want to be associated with positive emotions and positive moments in your life. And so with the NFL, they can get you, like, on positive moments because games are communal experiences and stuff like that. But everything that surrounds this, man, just doesn't feel good in the way, perhaps, that it once did. And so this got me to thinking. I've been reading this book in bits and pieces. I'm bad at, like, actually finishing books. But his book is called Brand NFL. It is a very interesting book. And it kind of starts in the 50s and 60s and gets around. It's kind of labor stuff and just what the NFL grew and became over years. But I think they said something, the author said something that was very, not really interesting because we knew this, but I hadn't thought about it in this way, is that Pete Rozelle, when he was commissioner of the NFL, Pete Rozelle is a PR man. And the thing that Pete Rozelle gave you was great PR, right? He handled those things flawlessly and he built the NFL up into this image that was almost unassailable. Now, the 80s came around, and then Rozelle had some fights that he wasn't quite prepared for. He didn't quite know what to do with drugs as that became an issue in the NFL, or the fact that there was this perception of this cocaine epidemic in the NFL, and then you look at what the numbers were that people were talking about, and it really wasn't that many dudes. Not to be, like, snorting cocaine in the 1980s. Like, it wasn't that. But anyway, they got, you know, it felt in reading that like the 80s felt very similar to now with a lot of the issues that were swirling around the league. And of course, the 80s had two player strikes. It's before we get to free agency, all of that stuff. But when it was time to replace Rozelle, they replaced him with Paul Tagliabue. Paul Tagliabue had been a lawyer at the NFL's law firm for the longest. Like, this is the guy that was going to succeed Pete Rozelle. Georgetown law graduate, you know, all of that stuff. But what it was that the game was moving into a new era and people were starting to see the value in stadiums. And they were viewing the NFL less about being in the sports landscape and more about being in the entertainment landscape. And what it required was somebody who had a broader sense and vision of what the business was going to be. And that was what Tagliabue brought. And so Tagliabue got the job, I want to say like 89, 90, whatever, and he kept the job for, you know, 15, 16, 17 years. And then they followed up with him with Roger Goodell. Now, normally when you wind up making a replacement as the commissioner, but just somebody that's in charge, you know, they talk about that game with coaches, how, you know, you got one kind of coach and you bring in the other one, you bring in a different kind of coach.
Yep.
Like the change of pace. The NFL didn't really do that. They hired a guy that was good for basically the same thing that Tagliabue was good for. They saw him as a guy that could make them money. This, you know, that he had a mind for the business of the NFL. And that's what they got when they hired Roger Goodell. And as far as the money making is gone, he has done a pretty good job by pretty much any indication. But you got to kind of wonder if at this time what the NFL kind of needs is a PR man. Like, again, now there were stretches with Rozelle where he was a PR man that didn't know how to handle the PR because I think the issues that then surrounded him were just kind of like out of his time. He wasn't prepared for what those things were. But the NFL's biggest problems right now are with PR. They're with credibility, is that when they say stuff, people don't believe it. And so they've made all their plays for money, and the 18-game season would be another play for money. But I really just think at some point, they're going to have to make a play for credibility, or have we just fully encountered an era where credibility has no value? Their credibility has no functional value. Because that seems to me to be the thing they need to do more than anything else. And nothing would erode the credibility of the NFL more than an 18-game season. All right, so did a television segment on High Noon's television show I do with my buddy Pablo. And we're talking about the WNBA and the complaints the WNBA players have about what their salaries are. And the discussion, it's very interesting to see the way a lot of you gentlemen in particular respond when this discussion comes up. Now, something that should be understood about the WNBA. The starting WNBA salary is $50,000 a year. In EuroLeague, the starting salary is at $100,000 a year. right? So let's not even get at this very moment to a comparison between how WNBA players and NBA players are made. Let's just look how women's basketball players are paid in the United States versus how they're paid in other parts of the world. Like, I think it was Diana Taurasi who said that she had to go to Russia to learn what it was to be paid the way that she should be paid. Like, the max pay in the WNBA is something like 100 G's. These are professional athletes. You know? That doesn't sound like the way that a professional athlete is treated. And see, I use the word treated there very pointedly because you have to understand what you get paid is really a proxy for respect in most industries. Now, that's how it works. Like, I can tell you, I've done the negotiating game in my business a few times. I've done it with a few companies, right? And you have different deals that you work on. And sometimes, look, you know that what is being offered to you is an amount of money that you are willing to take to do your job. And you know this in this business because the job doesn't change very much, right? I used to do local radio in Raleigh, North Carolina. I've done national radio for ESPN. The jobs were very similar. They weren't terribly different, right? Like, neither of them really. If I got to say, it might have required heavier lifting doing the local show than it did doing the national show. But I wasn't about to do this national show for that $43,000 a year working 6 days a week that I did the local show for. That would be silly. No. And if they would come up to me and offer me $43,000 at ESPN to do that job, you know what I would say to them? That's disrespectful. Pay is a proxy for respect in this game. Like, that's how it works. And so to me, the idea that WNBA players are paid what they are paid while the league also tries to sell you on the idea that they have star professional athletes, it can't be both at the same time because we're at a place in our society that that's not what you pay. Like, real live star professional athletes. That's not what you do, right? And it's not, again, it's not just not what you do here. It's clearly not what you do in Europe where they're paying them twice as much off the rip. So I bring that up. And I also brought up on the show this example. If you saw it, I'll tell it again, though. I was at the airport. I was flying out of LaGuardia. I was going to Atlanta to see my parents. And the LA Sparks were on my flight. And, like, I was at the gate. And the coach of the Sparks comes up and introduces himself to me. I'm like, oh, nice to meet you. And I'm like, huh, I thought your season was still going on. Like, I'm thinking this in my head. Like, why are you here at the gate? Then I'm like, oh, dang, the coach got to fly commercial. But I just thought the coach, because I didn't notice any other basketball players at the gate. So I go, I sit down, and then I look up after I sit down on the plane. I'm seeing these, you know, pretty tall women walk through, and I realize, oh, snap. They the L.A. Sparks. L.A. Sparks is on my flight, bro. Sitting behind me. You know? And so they're there. They're on the flight. I look back. You know, Candace Parker, she's taller than me. She in the exit row, right? I guess she sprung a little extra on her ticket. And so she's sitting in the exit row. And, you know, we get to Atlanta. That's about a 2.5-hour flight. Everybody gets off the plane. And I was just watching her walk through the airport, man. And you know what they look like? They look like they played a professional basketball game the night before and then had to jump on an 8 o'clock flight.
And then you had to go to the baggage claim and yeah. I guess they had to get their basketballs too.
Yeah, like how
the baggage claim.
Right, like however that stuff works, right? And then they had to play a game, Gabe, that night.
Man, I mean, it sounds like they're treating these ladies like it's minor league baseball.
Yes.
And that is not right.
Yeah, no, dude, you can't, like, that, like, seeing that and then them playing ball. And so one of my buddies knows a woman who was on the team, and she went to dinner with him after the game, and he said that she was apologetic, and she's just like, look, we didn't play our best, you know, we really didn't have our legs after doing this. Now, we're doing all this research now, or this research has come, about the effect of travel and fatigue and, you know, what it does to players' bodies and everything else, and like, those circumstances I described for you are a bit unbecoming of a professional athlete. Like, I just don't think there's any way around that obvious fact. It is unbecoming to ask professional athletes to put their bodies through what you're going to ask these women to put their bodies through and then treat them like that. Now, the counter argument is an obvious one. The league doesn't make money. And I get that because, like, private planes cost a lot of money. They really do. And it would be hard to justify a private plane for an operation that makes as little money as the WNBA does. I get where people are coming from in that regard. However, the NBA people, they're not in this to make money, at least not in this way. Because if they were in it with the WNBA just to make money, they'd have shut the WNBA down a long time ago. That's not really why they're here. There's a lot of benefits that the NBA gets from the existence of the WNBA. One thing about it is the existence of the WNBA is something that I would think, at least in theory, increases participation of girls in basketball. Like, it provides something for you as a woman to aspire to. And the reason I think that it's important, and not that there aren't other things in life for women to aspire to, obviously, but look, man, sports are a big deal in this culture. And being close to sports is something that is important. Everybody's got a football team. You know what I mean? And they identify themselves as such. So, like, there's a cachet and there's a power that comes from your relationship with sports. And there's also a power that comes from, like, being a high-profile athlete. Like, they have a special place in our society. We basically segregated out who can do that if we say that all we're going to pay attention to is men's sports and then like a handful of sports that women participate in. Like, you can't really have that, right? You put everybody at a distance in that way. You need to give people a chance to feel like they can embrace or feel like they're part of this. So if you are a woman and you are not like a basketball player, what options are we demonstrating to women that they can have around basketball? Because, Gabe, I look up and all I see is basically cheerleading. Am I wrong?
No. No, you're not. I mean, in terms of, like, the messaging there, that's certainly... Oh, I mean, you look at other sports. Other sports don't necessarily have cheerleaders.
Mm-mm.
But the NBA does. The NFL does.
Yeah.
And certainly when you have... like issues in the NFL with the way that they're treating their cheerleaders. It's also because they don't have like female football where they can treat them badly there.
Right. But it's like they are saying this is the place for women is right here. Right. Like to provide adulation to the men as they battle. But that's what it winds up saying. When you got your own league for women, you're also saying, well, another place for you is right here on the court. And guess what? I could be wrong, but I feel like if you are telling more people that there's a place for you on the court, you know what they're ultimately going to wind up doing? That's right. Watching more NBA basketball. Going to more NBA games. This all feeds the larger operation. But this only really works if you are treating the women who play women's basketball with the requisite dignity that comes from being a professional athlete, or what you have demonstrated that it means to be a professional athlete. Like, you can't just be like, why aren't you happy? We gave you your own league. No, like, the money they're paying them is preposterous. It is absolutely ridiculous. Like, and just something for you to consider here when we talk about professional athlete. I was talking to a dude not that long ago. He's a former professional football player. And he said that he could remember being 10 years old saying he wanted to be a professional football player. And the pictures he drew of himself as a football player would be a picture of him, a picture of a Lamborghini, and a picture of a model. Like, not even no trophy. You know what I'm saying? Like, no, he wanted the lifestyle. He wanted to be a star. Like, that was the thing that he talked about. That's what he wanted to be. Because when people talk about they want to be professional athletes, man, it's not just because they really enjoy playing the games. It's because there's some star power around it. There's some wattage to it. We can't just ask women to do this and just be like, be happy you get to play basketball. Because that seems to be, and that seems to be what the WNBA is saying with the money that they're paying. The thing that happened that day with the team from Las Vegas was flying to DC and they had been in transit for 23 hours and then they tried to make them get out there and play a basketball game. That's ridiculous. And it's ultimately just disrespectful. So I get the people who are like, well, this thing don't make no money. But it's not about money, man. It really is about respecting the way that they are treated. And if you view it in the context of how they are treated, not simply the way they are paid, then maybe some of your resentment then goes away. Except also a bunch of y'all are sheep, and y'all believe that not everybody deserves to be treated properly by their bosses. You don't think yourselves deserve to be treated properly by your bosses. Also of note, Gabe, I didn't know this, that the WNBA, their players get something like in the 20s of revenue percent, while the NBA players get 50.
Yeah, I mean,
but that, now part of that is because the NBA makes so much money. Like that is tied there, where the WNBA owners are like, "Look, we ain't got that much of revenue to begin with."
Yeah, because I mean, you have all the, male NBA players have so much marketing power.
Yeah,
and then with the WNBA, I mean, the stars of the WNBA don't necessarily have the marketing power that a LeBron James, mm-hmm. Or Kobe or someone like that has. So they're able to have the percentage because they deserve higher revenue, I guess.
Yeah. I think it's just ultimately the pie is bigger. And so the owners can afford to give you back 50 if the 50 that they're keeping is so much bigger, right? I think there's more to throw around. But let me tell you this. I did a little Googling last night. From what I could tell, working as a high-level executive in HR for the LA Sparks pays better than the median WNBA player.
No.
Yeah, because it's like but that's like a $90,000 a year job. Just to be clear, $90,000 a year job in LA, so that person ain't living high on the hog, you know? But yeah, there's people walking around the offices that's making more money than the players do. You see what I'm saying? Like this is, I don't see how anybody can understand why there is a problem with the players and the travel stuff and everything else. Cause the HR lady walk around making more than you.
Especially when it's like, we're doing so much for player health and science and all that sort of stuff, studies to try and make it so that the players don't get injured and, they're at optimal performance and all that sort of stuff. Yet, on the WNBA side of things, they're basically forcing them to do all of the things that the studies are showing are bad.
Yes.
To do for the NBA players. And we're like, oh yeah, Stephen Curry's going to be able to play the full season now because we're not doing back-to-backs anymore. It's like, oh, well, what about Candace Parker? What about Skylar Diggins?
That is probably the best way to put it. All these things, like we're over here telling these guys, hey man, y'all need to stop smoking. It causes cancer. And we over there handing them a bucket of lighters. Like, have at it. But I will say this. If I am making the point that WNBA players deserve to be treated better, I would make my comparisons more so, at least on the financial stuff, to what goes on in the European leagues versus what goes on in the NBA. Like, I think it was Skylar Diggins who said something about how Harrison Barnes is making $23 million and she was making whatever she was. I understand why you might feel that way. That argument is not going to win. It ain't going to win anywhere. Part of why it's not going to win anywhere, Gabe, is the dudes in the NBA that's like, I don't know why you make $23 million a year either. This is a function of free agency and all of the things that happen, but I don't think that basis of comparison goes very far in making the point. It is not an apples to apples comparison revenue-wise. With the NBA, they do make more money. Like there are going to be things that are associated there. Like I don't think you're going to get to a point, like you're not going to have multi-million dollar contracts in the WNBA. That's not going to happen. They should be better than what they are right now. But I think there's another thing that I will ask you before we go. And it's this. Why is it that the Euro leagues can make enough money to start salaries at $100,000 a year? And this league can't. Like, either there are some shenanigans going on with the books, and I'm not saying there are, I'm just saying these are only two options. Either there's shenanigans going on with the books in the United States, or there is just much more interest in women's basketball overseas than there is in the U.S. And why is that, if that's the case? Like, and look, I'm not saying this to you. I'm not one of these judgmental people that's wagging their fingers at you telling you need to go watch WNBA. I ain't really watching that much of the WNBA either. No disrespect. I'm just not. But why is it that it's so lucrative there and not here? Like, what is it about us that is different from them that makes it such that women in the United States have to go to like these other countries, like Russia's a big one, to make the real money and then just come back over here and you pay them with a hometown discount? Come on, something's wrong somewhere. All right, we'll be back with you if you haven't heard in just a second, but let me tell you something about FanDuel. It's been a long offseason without football, but FanDuel is spending getting in the best shape of their lives. FanDuel is ready for more. More ways to play, more ways to challenge your friends, and most importantly, more ways to win. If you're not a daily fantasy expert, the FanDuel is clearly the best place to play. They have all kinds of contests just for casual fans. In particular, check the Beat the Score contest. They're great because they pay out everyone who hits a certain score, so all you have to do to finish in the money to split an equal share of the cash. And FanDuel also has new options for playing daily fantasy with your friends, because the only thing better than winning cash is winning your friends' cash. Best of all, FanDuel is doing their part to make the preseason bearable with preseason fantasy contests running up to week one of the NFL. Right now, you can get a $20 bonus when you make your first deposit on FanDuel. Just sign up at FanDuel.com/Bomani. Age and state restrictions apply.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, Bomani, story number one comes from tech.
My name is Peter Holly, and I'm a reporter covering technology at the Washington Post. My latest story is about human microchips. Those are the tiny transponders that can be placed inside the human body and used to track people. Now, you probably associate microchips with dystopian conspiracy theories, government tracking, alien abductions maybe, but there's actually a firm in Wisconsin that's already begun putting microchips in their employees. They've been doing it for about the past year. The company is known as Three Square Market, and their microchips allow employees to open doors, to log onto their computers, or to purchase snacks from the vending machine with just a swipe of their arm. But now company officials are rolling out a more ambitious plan. Last week, Todd Westby, the company's chief executive, said that his company is working on a more sophisticated microchip that is powered by the human body and includes GPS tracking capabilities and voice activation. So company officials acknowledge that these microchips will definitely be used to track people, but not just any people. They say these microchips will be perfect for tracking people with Alzheimer's and dementia who have a tendency to wander. Three Square Market says that tracking grandma is a worthy cause, but of course, there's debate. So proponents of this technology point out that it can contain someone's entire medical history. If a patient is unconscious or suffers memory loss, these records could prove invaluable for emergency room doctors who might not know who they're dealing with. But critics of these devices point out that they raise serious privacy concerns. Any device that can track your movement raises a huge amount of data that can reveal intimate things about your lifestyle and how you behave. The only thing that most experts tend to agree on when it comes to this topic is that microchips inside your arm are an inevitability. It will happen to everybody, Noelle Chesley, an associate professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin, told USA Today last year. But not this year, and not in 2018, maybe not my generation, but certainly that of my kids.
We're doomed.
All privacy is lost, man.
Gay, we're doomed.
How far do we go to be able to swipe our hand in front of a vending machine to get another Snickers bar?
Dude, we're just, we're doomed, man. And like, you know what? The thing about old people, there's something to that. You know what that's going to lead to in that case? A spike in diagnoses of Alzheimer's disease. And we can all have it. Like, wow, man, I had somebody come in the other day, had Alzheimer's disease at 25. I'm so scared.
Yeah, I mean, if they're saying that, you know, this is going to be something that will become, you know, normal at some point. I do feel like that's going to be quite some time for now, you know, from now, just because at this stage, convincing people to have a microchip placed in their body from their employer, I don't know if I'd feel comfortable with that.
Nah, me neither. I have to admit, by the way, I turned, if you haven't heard, into like the spookiest segment in podcast, because it's all about how the future is going to kill us.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, all the stories that we get seem to be a little on the spooky side.
Yeah, I'm just trying to save them, man. I'm doing this for the culture. I'm doing this for everybody else, just to let you know what they got, what was around the corner.
All right, story number two. This is from tech, but it's also from the culture too.
Hi, this is Felix Salmon from Axios and the Slate Money podcast, and I've been looking at Elon Musk's ever entertaining Twitter feed, wherein one can find, amidst the Tesla tweets, occasional weirdnesses, like a tweet about T.S. Eliot, the great modernist poet who wrote a huge poem called The Wasteland. One part of it is called Death by Water, and it's about a Phoenician merchant called Phlebas who gets buried in the sea and washed away, and soon no one remembers his profit and his loss and his greatness and his handsomeness. He's just in the sea, dead. And Elon Musk tweeted this out, and everyone scratched their heads and said, why is Elon Musk tweeting this out? Some people think it has something to do with Ian Banks, who has written a book called Consider Phlebas, which is being turned into a TV series. I have another theory, which is that it came to Elon Musk from Grimes, who we are pretty sure is no longer dating him. We think they've split up. They've stopped following each other on Instagram, and Azalea Banks has seemingly confirmed that they've split up. And so I think that Grimes sent this little piece of The Wasteland to Elon Musk as a way of telling him to get over himself. And Elon Musk then tweeted it out saying, you've got to read T.S. Eliot's notes on this. The weird thing is, of course, that T.S. Eliot, although he did provide some notes to The Wasteland, didn't provide any notes for that bit.
This podcast is also Let's Laugh at Elon Musk. And more Elon Musk laughing. By the way, true or false, British accent make everything better.
Yeah, it does. How familiar are you with the whole Azalea Banks and Grimes and Elon Musk thing?
I didn't know anything about them together. I just know that she's a handful.
Oh, man. I mean, the part of the story where Azalea Banks was basically saying that she was left at, like, Elon Musk's mansion for several days.
What?
Yeah. Oh, boy. So Azalea Banks had come to Elon Musk's house, I guess, in L.A. to do some, like, recording stuff with Grimes. And then she showed up, and no one was there. And she was just, like, there for a couple of days, I guess.
Wait, you can get to, like, the door at Elon Musk's house, even if they're not there?
I guess, there had to have been some way that they let her in.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. The fact that they would. You know what I mean? Like, hey, man, if we ain't here, we ain't here. You ain't just going to wait for me to come back. I'm Elon Musk.
It's just like one of those, one of those movies where someone's walking around an empty house and they're just playing that, like, funny, you know, music in the background. Da, 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 da,
yeah.
You know.
Wow, yeah. Both Elon Musk and Isaiah Banks need to hang out with better people.
All right, our last story comes from business.
Hi, my name is Kevin Loria, and I'm a science correspondent at Business Insider. So the story here is that a Volkswagen plant in Puebla, Mexico, stirred up a ton of controversy by trying to control the weather and trying to stop hail with devices called hail cannons. Hail is a big problem for car manufacturers and anyone else who keeps expensive inventory outdoors. So to stop hail from smashing cars, the VW plant purchased these cannons earlier this year. The theory is that by firing shockwaves into the sky, they can break up hail before it forms. Now, farmers in the region say the cannons are working too well. They say that they've caused a drought, that it hasn't rained in the area since May, and they want $3.7 million in compensation. But no one really knows if hail cannons work. People have tried to stop hail for thousands of years. Caesar said that barbarians shot arrows at clouds. In 1750, the Holy Roman Emperors had to prohibit people from shooting guns at hailstorms. In the 1800s, people invented cannons that sent smoke up into the sky. And now, these modern hail cannons use sound. But scientists say we can't tell if they're working, so we don't know if they could cause a drought. Sonic booms from thunderstorms don't stop hail, and maybe the people who say that they work have just gotten lucky. Either way, the VW plant said they're going to put up mesh nets to catch hail, and they're only going to use the cannons as a last resort.
Yeah. I love about this game is the farmers say it's caused a drought. Like, that's the scientific proof we've got. They say.
Yeah, I know, especially when they're like, oh, well, there's no proof that it actually works.
Right. Nobody knows anything, right? Like, everybody, the farmers say it's causing a drought. They say they're stopping hail. Everyone is guessing.
It got me thinking about, like, some science fiction movies where, you know, these two, like, countries are at war or two civilizations are at war or whatever. And they, like, oh, let's fire the weather cannon and, like, make it's almost like X-Men or something where right. Halle Berry's character was, like, shooting them with a storm or something.
Right. Like, I see why this is a group, why someone's trying this. I just love the fact that nobody knows if it works. And the other people who don't know if it works are sure that it's causing a drought.
And so sure that they deserve almost $4 million.
Yes, yes, yes. Something tells me that their appeal will be denied.
The other part that I thought was funny about this, or just thinking about it, was that they need this weather cannon because so many of their cars are just sitting outside, right?
Yes.
So you have all these cars that are coming outside of the factory. Just even an, I would just be interested to see like an aerial shot of one of these places where you just have thousands and thousands of cars that are just sitting outside.
Yep.
Because you think when you buy a vehicle off the lot, it's like, oh, it's a new car. You know, it looks all nice and fresh. It's like, well, this car could have been sitting in a lot in Mexico outside for like 3 months.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess they got to do what they got to do. All right, we'll be back with your voicemails in just a second, but first a word from NetSuite. Has your company outgrown QuickBooks? Are shared spreadsheets, manual processes, and legacy systems costing you time and money? Now's the time to move your business to the cloud. Introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform. Now, with NetSuite, you can save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales, finance, and accounting, orders, and HR instantly right from your desk or even your phone. Thousands of the best-known brands and fastest-growing companies use NetSuite to manage their business, and now it's available to you. Power of the world's most popular cloud management system is more affordable than you think. Right now, in fact, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights to overcome the obstacles that are holding you back. And they're offering them for free. Don't miss out on unleashing your business's full potential with this free guide, Crushing the Five Barriers to Growth. You'll learn how to acquire new customers, increase profits, and finally get real visibility into your cash flow. Get NetSuite's guide, Crushing the Five Barriers to Growth, when you go to netsuite.com/Bomani now. Download their free Crushing the Five Barriers to Growth guide at netsuite.com/Bomani. netsuite.com/Bomani.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bomani. So we put out on Twitter for your worst date stories. Ones that people were actually at fault for and not necessarily something that...
Yeah, don't blame it on her.
Yeah.
You know you messed up.
So we got a couple of good ones. Our first one's from Aiden in Chicago.
Hey, Bomani. This is Aiden from the Chicago suburbs. So this was back before I had any game back in high school, but basically we had a really good date, went to the movies and everything, and I went to go drop her off at her house, and we were talking for about 5 minutes, and I was wondering why she was still sitting in the car. And, yeah, she ended up leaving after a little bit, and then I was driving home. I was like, man, why did she take so long? And obviously, she just wanted, something more. Thanks. Bye.
Oh, one of those mess ups. Yeah, I've been there. Like, sorry, I misunderstood what the situation was. And my stories of bad dates involving my car involved the fact that my car used to always be messy, like indefensibly messy. And so what I would try to do was just throw all the stuff into the back seat, right? Just to get myself to where I needed to be. But get everything, and sometimes they look back and see something that don't need to be seen.
Oh, boy. Or you wouldn't just put it in the trunk?
Nah, I would always forget, like, oh, that's right, I forgot I had to clean out the car. And the trunk might have been full of stuff, too.
Yeah, I mean, this guy, thinking after the fact, why was she hanging around for so long?
Yeah, why did she keep slapping my knee when she laughed at that joke that wasn't funny?
All right, this next one's from Wayne in Atlanta.
Yo, Bomani, this is Wayne Bryant out of Atlanta, Georgia. I'm calling to tell you about a bad date I had. So I was going out to the movies with my girlfriend, and we're going to see Pirates of the Caribbean. I legit fall asleep within the first 20 minutes of the movie. But no worries, though. She allowed me to sleep, and we still rocking to this day. Love the show.
Yeah, I don't really care about y'all still rocking to this day story. I remember the time I fell asleep on a date at the movies. I never talked to her again. Well, I did talk to her again. And the only conclusion I reached from talking to her again was I wasn't going to talk to her again. Not because I had beef, but because I didn't have the game to overcome however bad a date I had proven to be that night. Like, when you get done with one, you're just like, nah, don't think I got that job. Don't think that interview went well.
Do you nap often when you're out in public places?
No, I do not. I was just really, really tired. Because I had a very long day.
The GIF that's like taking the world by storm is you yawning on television.
Yeah, Pablo, this needs to be more exciting. Like, that's all that comes down to. That one was at night, man. I had, you know, gone to class and done all my stuff that made like an hour drive and all that. But nah, it was not my finest hour.
This last one, in the way that he explained it, it didn't necessarily seem like it was his fault, but there were parts of it that were his fault. And so I thought I'd play it just because I thought it had a funny result.
Hey, Bo. My name's Mike. I'm from Guilford, Connecticut. I had a lot of bad dates in my life, a whole lot. But I'd say probably the worst would have to be my senior prom, where I had a really hot girl ask me out, and I turned her down feeling honorable because I was doing a favor for a friend, another girl who said I said some stuff and, you know, made me feel guilty about it. I went to my senior prom with this random girl who spent the whole time trying to have sex with another guy who was in our prom party. So I, the whole time there and at the party afterwards, I'm just sitting by myself getting drunk while she's trying to get with this other dude who wants nothing to do with her. And at the end of the night, I locked my keys in my own trunk and I had to call my parents to come and unlock my car so that I could go home. It was truly, truly awful.
Oh, man. Some of that was his fault.
It was, yeah.
Like he made, wow. But I can't imagine he felt like he was doing the honorable thing by still going with this girl, and then she spent the whole night trying to get it cracking with somebody else.
Doing the, when he said that, you know, because I was trying to do the honorable thing, I was like, oh, man.
Oh, I remember on prom night, one thing that happened with us. We all got to prom, and then a whole bunch of people got rooms at the Ramada over off of 290, because we were in high school, so the Ramada's what you could do, right? And so we had been at the Ramada kicking it, and then we decided we was going to go to IHOP right up the street. It's probably about 4 o'clock in the morning, something like that. And so we come down the steps, and my man was like, yo, because the whole way his dad had a Suburban. And he's like, yo, I'm taking the Suburban to the prom. I'm like, oh, you going to be driving the Bourbon? Okay. So he came to the prom in the Bourbon. We saw the Bourbon in the parking lot of the hotel when we got there. Man, we walk into his car to go ride out to the IHOP. And I remember, never forget, my best friend, as we walking toward the truck, he's running toward us. He's like, turn around. Turn around, turn around. I was like, we go to my car. Yeah, because I didn't ask no questions. I just turned to red. I'm like, dog, what happened? He said, man, we went down to the Bourbon. And Fred was like, yo, man, my pops is in the car. He's like, what you mean? My pops, he laying in the car. Like, he said that like his pops just magically appeared in the car. No, dog, your pops drove you here. like that's how your daddy got here. He drove you here. Why did you not tell us this before we said we was going to ride with you?
Oh, man.
Yeah. Come on, man. That being said, I mean, good looking out for his pops to, like, you know, give him a ride home from the hotel. That's what I got. But all right, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We're going to get back to doing this thing 2 times a week in September. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thank you to FanDuel, and also thank you to NetSuite, our sponsors for the day. Also, thank you to Peter Holly. Check out the Innovations blog at the Washington Post and check his story on your workforce maybe getting microchipped up. Thanks to Felix Salmon of the Slate Money Podcast. He's talking about the Elon Musk tweets about T.S. Eliot. You can check that out. And also, thank you to Kevin Laurier, raised by Health and Science and Business Insider. Check out his story on VW's Hail Solution in Mexico. Also, we have not forgotten about the book club. We just had a couple things happen, but we will wrap that up in the month of September. Remember, check us out. ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. Only 4 stars. I'm going to think that you're a hater. Talk to you guys next week. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.